For 35 years, Roz Chass cartoons in The New Yorker have been making us laugh with their witty takes on the quirks of everyday life, but her latest effort is more ambitious, a full-length memoir told in cartoons, text, and photographs of her parents' last years, from their slow decline to their deaths at age 95 and 97. It's hilarious and heartbreaking in equal measure, and as we've come to expect from Ms. Chass, it also shines a light on essential truths about how we live today. Can't we talk about something more pleasant? It is published by Bloomsbury, and I'm delighted it has brought Roz Chass back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Many of your cartoons feel as though they have an autobiographical basis. Is this the most personal project you've ever done?
No, definitely. Definitely. I think with cartoons, they tend to be blends of people I know, people I've met once, people that other people have told me about, and people that I'm just making up. And this is much more specific.
And were you taking notes? Because this covers a number of years.
It was a combination of a lot of things. You might know, New Yorker cartoonists, we submit groups of cartoons every week. And so some of the cartoons in the book, like the one where I'm talking to my mother about the shoes and her theories about the shoes, or the oven mitt one, were cartoons that I had done as part of my regular weekly submission to the New Yorker and that were turned down. And I had them in, you know, my files. And when I put this book together, I used them.
Well, was it painful for you to write about the experience of dealing with your parents' difficulties in their final years?
Not completely. Sometimes it was really funny. But it was always very interesting, which is why I did it.
Funny in that you often are the person who's saying, am I the only sane person here?
Yeah, there's that. And, like, you know, like the oven mitt. I mean, it was kind of horrifying to realize that my mother's belief with an oven mitt was that you bought one in, you know, 1970 and you just used it until you died. Mm-hmm. And if it, like, started to get burnt or cruddy, you patched it.
Your parents were born 10 days apart?
Yes.
1912?
Yep.
Same fifth grade class?
Yes.
Were they childhood sweethearts?
No. My mother remembered him vaguely as the fat boy in the back of the room. My father, I don't think, really remembered her. And then they lost touch for many years. They met in their 20s. They were introduced by a mutual friend.
And then they had you when they were in their 40s.
Yes.
An only child.
Right.
Did that complicate family life?
I think for them, it probably did. they had tried to have a child many years before me, and it didn't work out. The baby was born at 7.5 months, lived for a day, and died. And I think it was such a horrendous experience, so painful, that they just didn't want to repeat it. I don't think that they were really, you know, none of their friends had children. They were very well ensconced in this sort of, like, Brooklyn school teacher world of childless couples that traveled, that did things. And, you know, suddenly they were people in their mid-40s with a baby. And they were old. They were, like, not young 40-somethings. They were, like, already sort of, like, this old school kind of people.
Was growing up in Brooklyn idyllic for you?
I hated it. It was... I didn't like it at all. I have no nostalgia for it.
You write that your parents believed that all contact with other people was dangerous. I don't know whether that's because you were growing up in Brooklyn. In a cartoon titled Sherlock Holmes, M.D., we see your mother trying to figure out who gave her a cold.
Oh, yeah. They were very conscious of all that kind of stuff. I mean, I grew up knowing probably more than I should have known about, you know, lockjaw and all kinds of, you know, things. I mean, my mother believed that somebody that she knew died from sitting directly on the ground, because she sat on the ground, like, as opposed to sitting on the ground without a blanket between your butt and the ground, and she caught a cold in her kidneys, and then she died. And, you know, they knew plenty of people that this sort of thing had happened to.
Is this hypochondria, or is this another kind of a thing?
I think it's exactly hypochondria. It's something else. I don't know what it is, but
It is finding medical solutions to all the problems of the world,
or finding medical problems in all the everything of the world.
When you got married, had kids, moved to Connecticut, how did your relationship with your parents change?
When I moved out to Connecticut, I did not see them as much. I had two little kids, and I did not go into Brooklyn. It was just too hard, you know?
You say for 11 years between 1990 and 2001.
Yeah, they came up to Connecticut. I mean, at first my mother drove. My father never learned how to drive, which was alarming, but she did it for a number of years. And then I just felt like, you know, her luck's going to run out. And so I kind of strong-armed her into getting a car service to bring them up. But I didn't go into Brooklyn for 11 years. That's
until
right.
September 9th, 2001.
Yeah. Yes.
2 days before.
Yeah.
Just an urge, a sudden urge?
Sudden, more than an urge, like a need, a real intense need to see them in their natural habitat.
And what did you discover?
That they were, their apartment was pretty dirty, and that it was more out of hand than I had known. That, you know, there were piles of newspapers and magazines everywhere, and they had stopped cleaning. And I think, you know, when I was only seeing them a couple of days at a time, I could sort of kid myself into thinking that they weren't really that old, or they didn't need my help that much, which is more to the point.
And they weren't asking for it.
And they were not asking.
People in similar situations often don't.
No, they did not ask for my help. But when I came to visit them, I realized that it was time to sort of get more involved.
Now, they weren't hoarders, but they were one step short of that.
Yeah, they were not hoarders. I think they had both grown up very poor, and they graduated from college into the Depression. And, you know, that is helped me understand them a little bit. I mean, my mother would have these little poems like, use it up, do without, make it do or do without. And, you know, so you wouldn't throw away a little sliver of soap. You'd, you know, gather up all the slivers of soap and sew them into a little washcloth. And you
don't throw away a coupon that offers you a saving, even if you don't cash in the coupon.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
My guest is Roz Chast. She has, can we say written a memoir?
Written, drawn, and
collated a memoir called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? We have some of the cartoons from the book on our show page at WNYC.org. We should point out that even though this is serious stuff, it's often very, very funny. And you've also reproduced some of your mother's poems.
Yeah. Yeah, she was a sort of amateur poetess.
So you are realizing that they were in some sort of decline.
Yeah.
You said, well, shouldn't you plan for the future? And their response was,
what are you talking about? But the thing is,
is that where the title of the book comes from?
Well, my father used to say, can't we talk about something more pleasant? And it was not just this topic. It was like any topic that made him anxious, you know, illness. But mostly, you know, this. But
end of life.
End of life sort of things. But I was equally wanting to run away from it. You know, it's a horrible topic. It's very difficult. There's no great answers to it. And it's really hard to talk about.
And judging from the cartoons, it was especially difficult for you as an only child because they outnumbered you.
Yes, that's true. That is true.
So how did you finally get them to put their affairs in order? Was it when you hired an elder lawyer?
Yes, that was really a wonderful thing. I didn't know that this profession existed, that there were people who specialized in this sort of thing. A friend of mine—
Mostly in setting up trusts.
Yes, well, yes, but also just there were so many things that I learned in this process. I learned about elder lawyers. I learned about what a healthcare proxy was or a power of attorney. All these were phrases that, I didn't even know. Maybe I had heard power of attorney, but it didn't mean anything to me.
They remained in relatively good health until they were in their 90s.
Yes.
And then things started happening.
Yes, yes. I mean, my father had senile dementia, and my mother, her body was falling apart. Her mind was sharp until the end, until the last few months.
But she fell off a ladder?
Yeah, she fell off a ladder.
In the hospital?
Yes.
Drove the nurses crazy?
Well, it was not just the falling off the ladder. She suffered from diverticulitis, and, you know, that was sort of the beginning of the big decline.
So you eventually convinced them to move to an assisted living facility near your home, which you called The Place. Was it difficult to convince them to move there?
It was so bad. They only agreed. I think the only way they could leave their apartment was my mother told my father and told me, well, George, we're only going up as a trial stay. And they took these two little tiny suitcases, like overnight bags, and came up to The Place. And I think they knew that this was it.
How well did they wind up adjusting to it?
Not terribly well. My father called it a hellhole. My mother said that they were inmates. And it was really, as places go, it was a very, very nice place. It was lovely, and it was 10 minutes from me. But still, it's a place, and they know that. It's an institution, and you're with every other person there is really old.
On the other hand, you had to clean out their place, their apartment.
Yes.
And that does sound like a hellhole.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So you were sifting through all of these things. I'm sure some of them brought back good memories, some brought back bad memories, and some were real surprises.
I think since I had never really gone through their stuff in intense detail before, I wasn't one of those kids who, you know, snuck into their parents' room and, you know, found porn or whatever. I was hoping to find...
Would there have been porn there?
I wish, but no, there was really not a lot of stuff. It was really just mostly old, falling apart stuff, you know, a drawer of jar lids and things like that.
Cartons of letters that they'd written to each other during the war.
That was probably the biggest surprise of all. And, of course, I took that with me.
And your father also was obsessed with bank books, many from banks that don't exist anymore.
Yeah. That was part of his senility, I think.
And he broke a hip, and then he died.
And then he died, yeah.
How much longer did your mother live? A couple of years?
A couple of years, that's right.
You describe the last months of her life in almost agonizing detail. As you describe it, she was well cared for, but was pretty much unconscious for much of the time.
At the very end, the last 3 months or so, she slept.
Do you think that being in a facility like that prolonged her life unnecessarily?
Yeah, I do, actually.
What kind of quality of life do you think she had during that time?
I think she was comfortable. I don't think she was in pain. But I also know that she wasn't reading or listening to music or, you know, writing poems. I mean, that had stopped a bajillion years ago. She was barely talking to me. Sometimes I would come and the aide would say that my mother had asked for some ginger ale. So she wasn't unconscious like in a coma. She was just alive, but barely.
But you're especially horrified by the nutritional supplement called Ensure.
Yeah.
Why do you see that product is so insidious?
The hospice lady said that sometimes they call it, you know, the people who administer these drinks, human feeding tubes. But the thing is, I don't know what it's like to be that old. I don't know whether, I mean, I'm seeing it from this perspective of, like, what's the point of lying in bed, just being fed Ensure and having yourself be cleaned by an aide? What's the point of that life? But maybe for her, it was okay. I don't know. I mean, to me right now, it just seems, it's like horrifying.
Well, you write that you never had a close relationship with your mother. Were you closer to your father?
I was closer to my father, yeah.
So did that make watching her very slow decline more emotionally confusing?
Yeah, I think so.
You have to find where you love her?
Excuse me?
You have to find in yourself where you loved her.
Yeah. It's hard.
You're very frank about your worries and guilt about the cost of the end-of-life care. Did most of your parents' savings go to pay for the place?
Almost all of it.
Do you think this has become a kind of industry, keeping people alive longer than they might wish to, just because we can?
I think it is an industry. I think that it's not like somebody is, you know, rubbing their hands together, you know, let's see how much we can squeeze out of it. But it's just the way it is. It's, you know, you get your parents into a place and they're comfortable and they say, oh, yes, $5,000 community fee. Okay, pony up, you know, and you have to buy them the furniture. And it's their money.
You can't bring furniture from the old apartment.
Oh, I could have, but it would not have survived the trip. I mean, their furniture was so old that I would open a drawer and the bottom of it would fall out.
How did this whole experience affect the way you think about death? I remember you once did a New Yorker cartoon about reading the obituary page, but that was long before all of these things happened.
I don't know if my feelings about death have changed because I don't know what it is. I mean, the whole thing just seems completely baffling, and the fact that, you know, we're here, we don't really know what that is, and, you know, everybody has different belief systems, and, you know, I don't know. I don't know what I think.
When you went through your parents' apartment to throw things out, what did you choose to keep, and where is it now?
I kept all the photo albums, or not the ones, actually not all, most of them. There were photo albums that they took, after I was gone, where they were on vacation and there were pictures of them with people I didn't know, and I just had no interest in that. But early photo albums, and I kept those letters. I kept a few mementos, but not very much.
And you include photographs here and other things along with your cartoons.
Yeah.
At the end of the book, you write that you keep your parents' ashes in your closet.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't throw them over the sea like so many people do.
Yes, Mummy and Daddy in their sailboat, and they always loved to sail around the coast of Maine. No, my parents didn't. We don't have a family plot. They never went out on a boat. You know, they liked the ocean, but I'm telling you, we would go to Manhattan Beach. They would go to the beach. They'd be wearing like their street clothes. So I really didn't know what to do. The closet seemed a good enough place.
Roz Chass will be signing books at the Denise Corey Gallery tonight at 7 o'clock. That's at 511 West 22nd Street in Chelsea. And then on Thursday, May 29th, she will be speaking at the 92nd Street Y at 8:15 for tickets. Ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And we should point out, in the interest of public broadcasting, your father's ashes are in a Channel 13 tote bag.
That's right.
The book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, is published by Bloomsbury. Roz Chass, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you for having me.